Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a department bill. Section 1 of the bill establishes an expedited process for the exchange of land between the state and governmental subdivisions of the state. In practice, most of the exchanges are between the Department of Natural Resources and the counties, so it'll be state land to state land. The focus is on consolidation of ownership. There will be a time and cost savings to the government and evaluation and the title work process. It will result in elimination of boundaries between ownerships and thus will reduce management costs for the parties involved. And it's also a goal of reducing forest fragmentation. This is part of an outcome of a team that was led by Senator Saxog over the interim, looking at how are there different means to reduce forest fragmentation in northern Minnesota. Subdivision 2 of Section 1 identifies the classes of land covered by this bill. Class 1 land is land managed by the DNR, except the school and university trust lands. Class 2 is tax forfeited land, and Class 3 is land owned and fee by a governmental subdivision of the state. This bill is not covering trust fund lands at this point in time. What we're looking at is it is reducing some of the time and effort that you need to do for valuation and title work. So we want to make sure that this process works, and before we add in the trust lands in a subsequent session and seek to do that, we want to make sure our fiduciary responsibilities would be completely fulfilled. So we said we want to be a little cautious and not doing the school and university trust lands at this point in time. Subdivision 3 provides an additional means to appraise the land. That includes the real estate broker's appraisal. And we also provide that the substantial equal value test, which is required in statute for land exchanges, must be met, but you don't have to actually equal acreage in exact value. One of the delays in land exchanges is that we have parcels on both sides that are substantially equal, but they're not exactly equal, and so you spend time adjusting acreage. Subdivision 4 allows title insurance to be used. Subdivision 5 recognizes exchanges require unanimous approval of the Land Exchange Board, which is the Governor, Attorney General, and State Auditor. Subdivision 6 is a technical provision of who goes first in issuance of deeds. Subdivision 7 provides that the land will have a reverter provision for 40 years. And this is to ensure the parties on all sides are serious about acquiring these lands for the purpose of management of the land and not for the purpose of turning around and selling them. So if you actually want to, once you have obtained them through the exchange, you want to dispose of them for some reason, you have to get approval from the exchange party involved. Subdivision 8 is a technical change that identifies that the lands acquired take on the classification of the lands given in the exchange. Section 2 of the bill concerns, which is just amended into the bill, concerns the requirement that the county board approve the DNR's purchase of land for wildlife management areas or scientific and natural areas. Currently, if the county board fails to act or fails to give a reason for disapproval, the DNR as a landowner may appeal to the land exchange board. But if the county board disapproves and provides reasons for disapproval, the DNR as a landowner may have to appeal to the district court. This bill removes the district court from the appeal process and changes it to the Land Exchange Board. The Land Exchange Board is the Governor, Attorney General, and State Auditor. And this change is consistent with the process currently in use by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on acquiring land in Minnesota under the Migratory Bird Conservation Act. If there's any questions on the bill, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. No questions by the members. I have a question. I'm not positive that it isn't. It has to do with this subject, but it isn't specifically on the bill. While you're up here, when a person gives land to the department or to the state, but in this instance the department, and they give it to them and say that as long as it's used for a specific purpose, that the department can continue to use it for that, and then later. And if it's discontinued for that purpose, then it reverts back. The owner never really lost. The owner always had title to it. So basically, they're loaning it. Is there some magic number of years out there that if that provision isn't re-established on the deed or the covenant that the DNR has loan of it, that the DNR then can then take the land. And I'm bringing this, I'm asking the question because in my community, I'm certain you're familiar with the Hamburg Marine Boat Launching Ramp that used to be a forestry station. Maybe you're not.
I'm not.
Very controversial. So that's my question. There's some magic number that a landowner always has to renew something on their covenant or renew an agreement with DNR, or the DNR just assumes ownership. Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chair, what you're talking about is the Marketable Title Act. It's Minnesota Statute Section 541.23. And this is to provide that titles to land are not fettered forever with other ties. And what it provides is more of a series of exceptions under that law. One of them is possession. But otherwise, if you have a reversionary interest, if you've conveyed the property fee but have a reversionary interest, that reversionary interest will be extinguished in 40 years unless you go to the county recorder's office and file an affidavit asserting that reversionary interest. So if you convey property to the DNR and you're conveying a fee with a reversionary interest, that reversionary interest, you could go in the 39th year, 11th month, file an affidavit and retain that reversionary interest. But if you do not, that reversionary interest extinguishes and the DNR would then own the property free from any reversionary rights.
Well, members, I this doesn't have anything to do with the bill, but I want to tell you about a situation that happened in my community. A person in my community that I never knew, who was a forester for the department, had a huge chunk of land where there's a marina built on it, and part of the land he gave to the DNR to use as a forestry station. He was a forester. They built a forest office on that piece of land and ran it for many, many decades. And he had given them and had a reversionary right. Of course, he died. The daughter, who's now in her 70s, she was not aware of this 40-year Section 5, whatever, she always believed that the reversionary right was in place. And her father had told her that if the department ever quits using that for forestry, that the land belongs to us. Now, members, I have to tell you, it's a huge amount of shoreline on Crane Lake, a massive amount of shoreline. I know Representative Cornish is familiar with the very location. And so the department tore down the forestry station and closed the station, and the family decided that they wanted rightfully so the land back. But the 40 years had expired. And so now there's a DNR boat launching ramp on that facility, and those people didn't get one stinking dime for that piece of property. And the other oddity about that is that these people that own it, and this is next door, this is like having a Wendy's and a McDonald's next door to each other, they own a marina, the biggest marina in town, and they have a boat launching ramp and 400 boat slips, but yet the DNR built on their land, which they never paid a dime for. Through that, what Mrs. Lewis did, and we're not hammering on you, Miss Lewis, but I'm just letting you know that there's things that happen out there that are, in my estimation, not particularly right. That doesn't have anything to do with this bill. I'm starting to sound like Representative Rucavina defending his constituents.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would pass the law to solve that problem.
Well, actually, Representative Rucavina, your former opponent and former representative, the college professor in Virginia. Who's the college professor that was the state rep?
Oh,
Elioff, Dominic Elioff, a Senator Ashback did pass a bill in the Senate. Is it Ashback? Senator that owned the island up in the Voyagers Park. Senator Ashback, correct. He passed a bill in the Senate, but Dominic Elioff refused to carry it in the House. So we wish he would have been in office then. Anyway, pardon me? No. Dominic Elioff was the one in the House. Anyway, I just would like to know, those things happen, and it just really troubles me, especially when the state is involved in it. That reversionary clause, I'm sure. Ms. Lewis, has anyone else ever been, do you know of anyone else that's been tagged by that reversionary clause by the department?
Representative Dill, the department normally does not have probably accept with reversionary provisions, but it does. And we do look at that one when we look at conveying and selling land, whether it has that provision or not. And we've had one or two instances where we're looking to sell land and looking to see if the reversionary interest is still valid. So there has been one recently that we've looked at. We haven't done any action with the property at this point.
Well, I remember someday when I get around to it, I'm going to author a bill to give that boat launching ramp to the rightful owner. That'll be plenty controversial. Anyway, on the bill at hand. Anybody to testify for or against the bill? There being none, any further questions by the members? And the motion is to send this to the environment policy, correct? So the chair will renew his motion on 3280 as amended to be recommended to pass and sent to Environment Policy Representative Eakins Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. God, I enjoyed giving that speech. All right, Representative Recomina.
Thank you.
The chair will move House File 3424 for possible inclusion in the omnibus lands bill. Representative Recomina, to your bill.
I think you have an amendment in the packet, AOA 1210.
Stand by one.
So if you could move that, it's
okay, the chair will move AOA 1210 amendment to House File 3424. Discussion on the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
230. Motion is prevailed. To House File 3424 as amended. Representative Recovina.
Chair and members, this bill is before you because the currently the county can, on county tax forever land, you can only do a 10-year lease. And on state land, as you mentioned, there's a 40-year lease you can do with approval of the executive council, but you know, we're, there's some concern that that the wind energy might not be interpreted as a commercial enterprise. So that's the reason the bill is before you. Members, they're right now, they're putting 10 windmills up at U.S. Steel's Mintac plant on the Laurentian Divide, and no one ever thought that northeastern Minnesota, with all the trees and everything, would be capable of having wind energy. But we've put an anemometer. I can never say that word. You know, there are things that measure wind, and it's very the wind up there is beneficial enough that you can have wind power. In fact, on this weekend, I talked to one of the guys at the head of the project for Minnesota Power that's putting up the 10 2.5 megawatt turbines. Those blades are the largest blades in the United States of America. Four people can stand inside the hollow end that attaches to the turbine. I suppose 10 of me could stand up in there. But anyway, they're just huge. And we were trying to look at a couple other sites, and we ran into the fact that most of our land, if it isn't owned by the mining company, is owned by either the state or the county. And so we ran into this lease problem. I think the Department of Natural Resources supports the bill as the amendment it currently is, and so I'd ask for your support so we can move forward on a few more wind projects besides the one at Mintac.
Okay, members, how about questions of Representative Rokovina? Anyone? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question, Representative Rukavina, is this going to get us in trouble with the education people or the tax people on school trust land and all that? I'm with you on this. I'm just wondering if this is going to be controversial down the road.
In fact, I think the purpose is to make sure that we can have some of these, because no one's going to, as an example, I think Mr. Serfenik was with me, and I don't know if he wants to say a few words. He probably doesn't have to, but we put up one of those measuring devices, and then we ran into this problem after we put it up and paid
what
about...
What was that measuring device again?
Anemometer. Anemometer? Is that right?
I don't know.
Did I get it right? I don't know. But anyhow, all of a sudden they said, well, you don't normally... You're not necessarily going to get the bid. Well, why would a wind company or somebody seeking to do all that investment and then not get the bid? So, you know, I don't know how that's going to be. We shouldn't run into a problem. It'll go into the forestry suspense account and disappear anyway, the money. So you don't have to worry about that. The DNR will get it.
Well,
and Harness will make sure it goes to the game warden. So.
Yeah. You're in the right committee to criticize the department. So, anyway, Ms. Lewis, you want to testify, or are you good to up or down on this? Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DNI has no opposition to the bill as amended. It was heard last Thursday in the Senate, and the amendment reflects the language in the bill. The department does have authority under existing law to issue wind energy leases, and we are going to be looking at the issue a little bit more in the next few months, and we may have further changes to bring back at the next legislative session for looking at this issue.
Okay, so this gets us, so we have the same language in both bodies then?
That is correct,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Good. Mr. Gvenick, you want to come up and practice a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Gary Sirkvenik representing the Mountain Area Economic Development Authority, which is the sponsor of the wind project. I've learned a long time ago, the less said, it's the better. However, in this case, we are establishing a seabed project for a community, a political subdivision of the state of Minnesota in combination with other political subdivisions. And so once the project's up and running, we will pay a lease to the DNR and to St. Louis County for the land at this site. And the profits derived from the project over a 30-year period would go to those economic development agencies, which is the intent is to put the money back in the community, which is the intent that the legislature had when they passed the seabed bill. And so I think this is a neat project, and I appreciate your support for the extension of the leases.
Okay, any further questions? Being none, the chair renews his motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Rickman.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
As amended. So that would be House File 3424 as amended. Okay, members, we're going to take up House File 3032, which will be the vehicle for the lands bill, waive the lands bill. So the first thing we'll bring the bill before us. The chair will move House File 3032. Ms. Lewis, if you could come up and explain any of the things in the DNR technical provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is our typical omnibus boundary and sale bill that we bring forward every year that also becomes the vehicle for the various tax bucketed land sale bills. Section 1 of the bill is a technical change that comes basically from our past commissioner, Jean Merriam, and it concerns the critical habitat account. Technical changes make it clear that the DNR can accept a contribution and agree to match the contribution if there are future appropriations. This does not make the contribution itself contingent on the appropriation, just the match. Section 2 and 3 of the bill are also technical changes to the outdoor recreation system components. A few years ago, the aquatic management areas were added as a unit of the outdoor recreation system, but they didn't change the other parts in 86A to recognize them as units and recognize how they fit within a secondary management unit. We also, as we were doing that, noted that for state recreation areas, wildlife management areas had also been missed. So we were technically getting that cleaned up. Section 4 of the bill adds land to 7 state parks, the Buffalo State Park, Frontenac, Monson Lake, Savannah Portage, Phoenix State Park, Sudan Underground Mine, and William O'Brien State Park. Section 5 deletes land from 4 parks, Frontenac, Lake Carlos, Lake Chetek, and Moose Lake. Section 6 of the bill adds land to the Garden Island State Recreation Area and Lake of the Woods. These are the 3 outcrop islands that are being transferred from the United States government. Section 7 adds 80 acres to the Birch Lake State Forest in Stearns County. This will improve access to the state forest. And then sections 8 to 16 of the bill authorize sale or exchange of DNR-administered land. Most of the sale parcels are small or isolated. Legislation is required for sales because of parcels border water or a direct sale or transfer being proposed. For some of the parcels, it would be best if the land was managed by a local unit of government rather than the DNR. The bill also addresses resolution of several unintentional trespass situations. Mr. Chair, can you go into any further detail on any of the sections if the members have questions?
Okay, before we go any further, we're going to, you have an amendment, the A08-1209 amendment. Then that should get the bill in the department's order, as I understand it. I'll move the amendment, and any questions on the amendment to get the bill in the shape we need it from the department? All in favor of the 1209 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the bill 30, House Bill 3032 is amended. And now, anything to your amendment, Ms. Lewis?
Mr. Chair, amendment takes the Lakes to check. The roadway was not described in as detail in the draft. Our surveyors had gotten out there and identified the full description, so that's what most of the amendment is. And then the last one is, which is on page 3, lines 25 and 26. We had an error in our legal description for a parcel being transferred, authorized for sale by St. Louis County, so we needed to correct that.
And Ms. Lewis, there's nothing in this bill that has any boundaries of the Vermilion State Park?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Nothing in Vermilion State Park is concerns this bill.
Thank you. All right. Any questions on the bill as it's before us at this time?
Are there more amendments, Mr. Chair?
Yes, there's a... There's a 1202 amendment, which is the St. Louis County amendment that is next to be amended into the bill. And then, Representative Hackbarth, all the bills that we heard earlier, we're going to then amend in and incorporate into this bill. So with that, we'll bring the chair will bring the 08-1202 amendment before the committee. And Ms. Lewis, have you reviewed the 1202 amendment, the St. Louis County amendment?
Mr. Chair, yes, the DNR has reviewed the amendment, and we have no objections to the bill.
All right. Any questions by the members? There being none, all in favor of the 1202 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. 1202 is adopted into House File 3032. And now, members, we're going to move all of the bills that we heard this morning. So I'm going to make that in one motion to include in House File 3032, House Files 3258, 2924, 2925, 3169, 3250, 3379, 3424 as amended, 3499, 3502, 3075, all to be included in House File 3032 as amended. So any discussion on that motion? Mr. Meyer, did you want to come before us for any reason? I see you walking up here. Come right up and introduce yourself. You need to talk on this particular motion.
Mr. Chair, members, is this on the land bill itself?
Yep.
Yes.
I do have an amendment I'd like to talk to the committee about at some point in time, either moves out of the committee.
Let us adopt these bills as an amendment into the main bill, and then we'll go back to your proposed amendment. So any further discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. House File 3032 is amended. And now, members, the chair will move the 1217 amendment, the Meyer amendment. Mr. Meyer, to your amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, I do apologize for the lateness of this amendment and not being able to discuss with you beforehand. We're in the process of working with Military Affairs, Veterans Affairs, to possibly establish a new cemetery in the Duluth area. The amendment before us allows us to begin that process. It allows Military Affairs to begin in negotiating with the federal level, federal government, to receive funding for this cemetery. It's a portion, I don't have the map with me, I can provide it to you. It's a portion that is cordoned off by a railroad on one side of the park and a county road on another, which is County Road 23 is Veterans Memorial Highway as well. So we've been looking for a site for some time. It's just a placeholder that allows the military affairs to move forward with the location of with their paperwork, I should say, at the federal government level.
Okay, questions on the 1217 amendment. Ms. Lewis, you're good to go. I'm considering the bosses here.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine with the bill, and I drafted the language on Friday. So.
It gives you a chance to hit nailing, you know. All right, all in favor? So the 1217 is a further amendment to House File 3032. In favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we're going to lay over House File 3032 for later consideration this evening because we have at least one other lands bill that's going to come before us being introduced today. And then we are, Mr. Meyer, Bob Meyer, you took off before I could tell you. What I'd like you to do tonight, we're going to add on to the agenda tonight. I want to hear about the Knife River Knife River Island cormorant issue and what the department is intending to do regarding that. So I wanted you to know that in advance so you could get the resource people here to talk about that. It just seems to be a burning issue. I'm certain you are aware of it already. And with that, members, we will recess until 4 o'clock this evening. Thank you very much for your patience. For possible inclusion. Representative Bingham, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3444 deals with expanding the fall only turkey hunt in Permit Area 601, which is predominantly the metro area. And because of restrictions for firearms, local ordinances, city ordinances, which this won't change, but because of city ordinances for gun and archery hunt on animals, we're getting a population, that of turkeys that is starting to increase and creep up. And, any given day in the fall and in the spring, you can drive down Highway 61 in my district and look in the Newport Cemetery, and there's turkeys there, and they come down into the highway to the...
Representative Bingham, turkeys with feathers?
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. And they're big, and they we need to make sure that we have a controlled population. And so I've spoken with the National Turkey Federation. They sent a very nice letter supporting the bill. And the Department of the DNR didn't really have any problems with the bill. They are also looking at some rulemaking changes that may help with the suburban and urban area turkey population. But I will stand for questions. And
good job. All right. Anyone in the audience testify for or against the bill? Mr. Boggess, you thumbs up or down on the bill? Thumbs up. Mr. Boggess from the DNR indicates that they are in a concurrence with the bill. Representative Hansen, you have a question on the bill or comment on the bill, House File 3444.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham. And I talked with the chair about this, that with the turkey season, turkey zones, turkey landowner-tenant issues, cycling and all that, we've had the wild turkey program has been very successful in Minnesota over the last 30 years, and it's one of the great success stories in wildlife management. But it might be a good time to just review the program. I know that the landowner-tenant issue has gone back and forth. Just direct DNR to involve some people and take a look after 30 years what we should do. I know there's been various groups in the past, but we've got a couple turkey bills here, and I think I'm a member of the Wild Turkey Federation. It would be a good time just to maybe take a broader look back. I don't oppose the bill. I think it's a good thing, but there's a lot of we could just have a lot of bills coming like this that, that tweak something here or there. So that's just my suggestion, is maybe a little broader look.
Absolutely, Chair.
Representative Bingham.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, thank you for that. I agree that patchwork, policy isn't always a good thing. So I think a comprehensive look at the turkey hunt is a good idea.
Okay. Well, Representative Hanson, I would tend to sense that you have agreement with me on this. Why don't you consider working with Mr. Vargas and Mr. Meyer, and when we get to policy or finance, we can possibly add this into the game and fish bill as we go. It wouldn't be bad to review this, because I am getting quite a few people are coming forward and saying, we want this tweak or that tweak or so on and so forth, and maybe something good could come of that. Okay? Any further discussion on House File 3444? There being none, Representative Bingham renews her motion for possible inclusion in the game and fish bill. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much. The next bill up is an Eakin bill. House File. House File 3546, and we have an honor today to have the Honorable Senator Scoyer to present the bill. The Chair will move House File 3546. We're moving that for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. Senator Scoyer, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Rod Scoyer, Senator from District 2 for the tape. House File 3546. Representative Eakin is carrying it for me in the House, but this really is a bill that I drafted that came about at a number of meetings that we've been having up in the Upper Red Lake area. Upper Red Lake is a managed lake, seasonal or special management water lake, and they have a two fish limit and a plot size, and they have very good meetings with regard to the management of the fishery in these lakes with the local resorters, the DNR, and it really is very productive. The meeting I attended last summer, they were having a discussion about whether to extend this to a three fish limit or whether to expand the slot or reduce the slot or go to 18 inches from 17 and a half. And they're doing all this prospectively, trying to anticipate what the catch is going to be in the coming year. And one of the members of the committee had an idea that I thought was worth exploring, and that was that they would have left the season at two fish, left the slot size alone, and then as the fishing season would have gone along, if the catch wasn't what they were expecting it to be, they could extend the season for a week. That's a real good deal. The resorters liked it a lot. Because, up in northern Minnesota, we've got good solid ice, and they could, leave the houses out and have a week longer of business. And also, I think it would be better for the fishery, because then, as they would be making changes, they would have the knowledge of what has happened in the previous summer and currently in that winter. And so we drafted this bill. It's permissive, as you would see, to the Commissioner May in both instances. Extend the season, and this would only be, in cases where they feel it would be a positive for the fishery. This winter, actually, on Upper Red would be a real good example of a time when this would be a useful tool for the DNR to have in their toolbox, and despite increased fishing pressure, the bite just isn't there this year, and they really haven't caught anywhere near the amount of fish that they would have been expected to take through the winter season. So, Mr. Chair and members, I would hope that you would consider this. I've had discussions with the DNR. They recognize it is permissive, and certainly would like to see if this is something that they could utilize as they manage our fisheries.
Okay, thank you, Senator. And any questions for the Senator? Doesn't look like there are any. Ms. Shad, I don't see Mr. Pyre in the audience. Do you folks want to comment on this from the department? Mr. Meyer, Mr. Shad, Bogus, any of you? See Mr. Shad coming down. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Dave Shad, Director of Fish and Wildlife Division, DNR.
and we haven't had a lot of opportunity to talk about this bill internally. As the senator indicated, it is permissive, and so we appreciate having that flexibility. There certainly are years like this one where the harvest was less than expected. I think one of the challenges we'd face in trying to extend a season like this would be anticipating what the summer harvest would be. The harvest season actually starts in December, goes through the winter, and then into the summer. And so if we were going to make the decision to extend the season, the winter season, we would have to be fairly confident that wouldn't put us into an over-harvest situation once we go through the summer months as well. So,
Senator Clark.
Thank you. And I understand that there is a difference between the management season and the fishing season, but we've had discussions with the fishery folks up in the regional office, and they think because they tend to manage on a three-year average, that they could work around that. Now, it might be something that they would have to make some little adjustments to, but I would hope that that wouldn't be an overwhelming obstacle.
Okay, further questions from the membership? Okay, Chair will renew his motion to lay over House File 3546 for possible inclusion in the game fish bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming over. Included. Okay, and now we have okay, members, we'll now, the chair will move House File 2501 for possible inclusion in the the chair will move House File 2501, and the next step for this bill will be environment policy if it survives this committee. So Representative Yaros.
Mr. Chairman, Nancy Hilden.
Welcome.
Just letting you know that Representative Yaros just informed me that he had to run out and make sure his car didn't get towed. he is sorry, but he will be right back, but he had to run outside immediately.
Well, why don't we go ahead then with, I think that everyone on this committee is familiar with the issue, and we go ahead with Mr. Goldman from the Humane Society. Why don't you come forward? We'll start our testimony on the bill. Welcome, Mr. Goldman, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, and then proceed with your testimony on House File 2501, which is before us, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Howard Goldman, and I'm the Central States Director for the Humane Society of the United States. We're the largest animal protection organization in the country. We have 2 million members and supporters, and 159,000 members in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I do have some written material which I will hand out as soon as I conclude my testimony, and it includes several letters and endorsements in my testimony as well. I'm here to support House File 2501. Many dogs have been protected or were protected in Minnesota from 19 for assaults for 58 years, from 1946 to 2004. Not exception in the state of Minnesota, and we're supporting passage of this bill. I was involved in many previous efforts to establish a season. All of it failed in 2004, and I think the reason for that is pretty straightforward, namely that Minnesotans care deeply about this particular species. Shooting mourning doves serves no wildlife management purposes. Dogs don't prevent a threat to agricultural crops, homes, or even rest for that matter. They actually benefit agricultural crops because they're ground feeding birds and for this reason they're called the farmer's friend. And no one suggested that dogs are overpopulated in Minnesota. During the hearings in 2004, we were told that there was widespread support in the state of Minnesota for a dozen season. And the projected were close to 50,000 hunters would be given permits over the next year or two to hunt dogs in the state. What in fact has happened is just the opposite. Over the past 3 years, we've had between 11 and 15,000 hunters, and in the most recent season, only 13,000 hunters representing the 06 season, that is the season for which we have the hard information. There are many other species for hunters to shoot. There are at least 109 species that are considered game species in the state of Minnesota, and 48 of these game species are bird species. Doves are not a viable human food source. They only weigh about 4 ounces. Fully dressed, they're little more than 2 ounces. Doves shooting contributes directly to the discharge of toxic lead shot. For every dove shot in bag, hunters discharge an average of 8 shots. That's according to a long-term study by the U.S. Geological Survey and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The study also concluded that densities of greater than 860,000 pellets per hectare have been reported in dove fields. These lead deposits pose a significant risk to ground feeding mourning doves, other wildlife that directly and indirectly ingest toxic shot. The shooting of doves raises many ethical concerns. Many dove hunters, we believe, shoot doves strictly for target practice. And they don't retrieve the bird. The wounding rate is fairly high, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Doves, I've been told, are fun to shoot. They fly erratically. And they make good targets. Shooting doves is known to produce orphan young. Doves have the longest nesting season of all North American birds and are known to be nesting during the 60-day shooting season in September and October. Doves mate for life, and because both parents are usually required to successfully fledge their young, killing one parent is known to cause unnecessary suffering of the dependent young who oftentimes die of starvation. There's also an unacceptably high wounding rate associated with shooting doves. Scientific studies demonstrate that there's an average wounding rate of 30% in hunting areas, meaning that one in every three bears is wounded but not killed outright. Minnesota, there's no tradition of dove hunting. There are few Minnesota hunters that have the experience of shooting doves, and then they even see a higher wounding rate. Minnesota voters oppose the shooting of doves. The poll conducted the state fair in 2003. It was a random poll conducted by the Minnesota House of Representatives. They polled over 7,400 people, revealed that 18% favored dove hunting, 56.5% opposed it, 23% were undecided. There's also a significant economic impact. Mourning doves are song birds, they're backyard birds. They're an important part of the multi-million-dollar bird watching and bird feeding industry in Minnesota. More Minnesota residents participate in wildlife watching and spend more money doing it than any other outdoor activity, including all forms of hunting. There are about 540,000 hunters in the state who contribute an estimated $500,000 to the state economy through their hunting-related purchases. However, there are 1,946,000 bird watchers in the state who contribute over $650,000. And in the material that I'm going to pass out, there's a letter from the Archbishop, Harry Flynn, who supports us on this effort. And I'm going to read the last sentence, and I will provide copies to all of the members. The Archbishop states, "Mourning doves are gentle, friendly birds that are considered the emblem of peace and the harbinger of spring in the Bible." And who's a greater authority on the Bible, of course, than the Archbishop. "With this in mind, we support legislation, House File 2501, that will once again protect Minnesota mourning doves from hunting." There are some statistics I'd like to share with you, too. In the course of completing my research on this, I reviewed the Minnesota Dove Population Status Report prepared in 2006, prepared every 10 years, by the Fish and Wildlife Service. In the introductory paragraph, they state that the central unit of which Minnesota is a part has shown a significant decline in the dove population over the past 10 years. Let me give you a few specifics, and I'm not saying the dove is endangered or threatened in Minnesota. It's not. And what's pretty clear when you look at the data is that the dove numbers are declining. They do three separate analyses, training lines. One is the number of mourning doves heard along call count surveys from 1996 to the year 2006. They did a cumulative linear regression. In Minnesota, they found a decline over those 2 years of over 5%. The second analysis they carried out was the number of mourning doves seen along call count survey routes, same timetable, 1996 to 2006. They saw a decline over those 2 years of 7%. And perhaps the most telling statistic of all was a 40-year analysis they did on breeding populations, and they found that the breeding population had declined by over two-thirds over that same time period. Again, I'm not saying that mourning doves are threatened or endangered in Minnesota. What I'm saying is the trend is pretty clear. The numbers are declining. And of course, why should there be a season? I'm thinking, of course, about the wildlife management side and also the ethical side here, for all the reasons I've already noted. Why should we simply add additional pressure to the species where it's pretty clear that the numbers are declining? The Minnesota Humane Society, along with several other Minnesota-based wildlife and animal welfare organizations, support this legislation. And in light of the fact that doves are not there's no trophy value, no need value, and for all the reasons I've cited, we urge you to pass this legislation. There are three other speakers here today. Susan Janelle is here, and she's going to speak on behalf of the Midwest Association of Avian Rescue Services. And I will, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I know there may be a question or two. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Ms. Brunell, introduce yourself and for the record, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Susan Brunell, and my background is a veterinary technician. I also do volunteer for MARS, which is the Midwest Avian Adoption Rescue Service, the Raptor Center, and I for the Wildlife Rehab Center. I'm a former hunter. I don't hunt now. I have decided to focus my attention on rescue and rehabilitation. I am very interested in birds because birds have not gotten the same amount of attention as some other animals, and I think they deserve that attention. I'm concerned about the mourning doves. Mr. Goldman had mentioned some of the reasons about their weight, 4 to 6 ounces. It takes about 4 to 5 birds for one meal for one adult. These birds are flock birds, and when they fly, they're very skittish. They fly erratically. They can change speed and direction very, very quickly. I spoke with one of the veterinarians at the Wildlife Rehab Center and to confirm this, and she says that as when they are let out, they fly every which way, which would make it very difficult for them to hit and more difficult to actually kill. When these birds are wounded, they tend to blend in very well with the vegetation, which makes them very difficult to find, and they can suffer a prolonged death. I have a letter, and I think you should have it in front of you, from a veterinarian. I'd just like to read one part of that letter, a real short part. Speaking of wounded birds, it says, birds often hide themselves in heavy cover when first wounded and eventually seek food and water if they're able. By living off their own body stores of energy and foraging for food, they can sustain themselves for lengthy periods of time, sometimes living for many days or even weeks with serious injuries. All the while, these feathered creatures suffer no differently than what a human deprived of appropriate medical care. I also have this letter was from a veterinarian who's also a hunter. The second letter that I have here is from actually my brother, who's been a hunter for 40 years. And this is what he had to say. It says, I've hunted mourning doves in Texas and have found them to be challenging to hunt due to their small size and flight maneuvers. I've also been with fellow hunters who have shot and left mourning doves in the field because they were too small to eat but were fun to shoot. I don't want to insult any hunters here that are responsible, because there are many, and there are some here. I know they're responsible because they wouldn't be here if they weren't. But I believe that these birds are being used as practice. There is was a statement made by a DNR officer in an article that I read that stated they're a good bird for adults to teach our youth to hunt. And I would say that it would be better to find a bird that is larger to hunt, which would be much easier to actually kill than these little creatures that are being used as practice. I don't think that that sends a very good message to the youth. I have talked with other hunters who have said that they are practice birds. And I have some concerns. One of them is I know that they're not in threatened right now to become extinct, but there have been cases of other birds that have been shot. The Carolina parakeet is one of them, and the last one actually died in 1918 in a zoo in Ohio because they were overshot. They were used for their feathers. The other one is a passenger pigeon who is the cousin, very close DNA to the mourning dove. And that bird is also extinct, and the last one also died in the zoo in 1912. I believe that these birds should not be used for the purposes of that many are using them for. And I would just ask that you consider removing these birds from the game list. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Burnell. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Arthur from Minneapolis Audubon Society. Welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Well, I'm John Arthur of the Audubon Chapter of Minneapolis. Let me just get my notes here. Okay. Well, let's start out with, I've also spoken with the representatives of the Zumbro chapter of the Audubon Society, as well as the president of the, president of Zumbro and representative from St. Cloud Audubon, and they are also opposed to reinstating the dove hunting bill. Our chapter in Minneapolis in 2004 actually supported that, or at least the board of directors supported the dove hunting bill. I then heard from our membership that we were wrong. They did not like that. So they let me know that that was a bad decision, as well as the other board members. So we'd like to come out now and say we are not for it. We have too many of our membership point out that the dove is a small bird. You got a couple ounces of meat. I don't see that many recipes, you know, for mourning dove. I don't see anything like mourning dove feeds like you would see a game feed. I when you go to a game feed, you get venison, you get pheasant, you get duck. Those are good things. A turkey is a very large bird, very good. I do not have any problem with hunting at all. Our board members, we have a couple of hunters on there currently. We've had other hunters on the board. We had one of our board members was actually teaching class in duck identification for us non-hunters, teaching by the outlines, the profiles that you see that are handed out to hunters. We really like that. We heard somebody talk about, well, we'd never be able to hit a duck with a mourning dove with 8 shots. You'd never have time for them being in the air that long. We aren't talking about 8 shots at one bird. You're talking about 1 out of 8 shots actually connecting with the bird. The rest of those shots land in the field. So that leaves a lot of lead or whatever shot is out there. If it's lead, that's a problem. If it's steel shot, not so much of a problem. I also heard an analogy today about a sunfish being a very small fish, and also people catch them, and that only provides a small amount of meat. You need a lot of fillets for a feed. That's very true. But when you go fishing for that sunfish, you pull the hook out when you're done.
You don't catch something, you pull the hook out. It comes out of the water. It doesn't leave shot in the environment. Okay, there is cases, of course, of leaving lead sinkers out there, which is also, the DNR opposes that. We know that. We're hearing about young hunters using the mourning dove to learn. I think there's better birds to learn on. I find a duck, you know, whether it's a mallard, a blue-winged teal, many of the other birds that are very good, they fly in a pretty straight line. If I'm tracking with my shotgun, I'm going to be able to hit that a lot easier than I am a crazy flying mourning dove. And then after that, what have I got? If I shoot a duck, I've got something to eat. Okay? So, anyway, as I said, our chapter does not feel that we need a mourning dove hunting bill. We're not opposed to hunting at all. That's really all I had to say. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your time. Any questions? Thank you very much. And I'll rep them to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Arthur, I don't know if you're the person for this, but I'm don't like to admit that I don't know if a mourning dove is a native bird, but are mourning doves native to Minnesota and North America?
They are native. Things like the ringneck pheasant are not. That's an introduced species that is used for hunting. And I really don't care for non-native species, but that's a personal opinion.
Thank you very much. And we have another testifier. State your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, honored representatives, audience, and citizens of Minnesota, my name is Bill Oldfather. I live in May Township, north of Stillwater, and I've been volunteering for the Green Party of Minnesota for 6 years. I'm truly honored to be representing the Green Party of Minnesota. This prepared statement, which I'm about to read, was a collaboration of three leaders of the Green Party and is thought to represent the views of the Minnesota State Green Party and its platform, the National Green Party and its platform, and the Green Parties of various nations of the world. Please feel invited to explore and join the Green Party, the Party of Peace, the Party of Reform, the Party of Ecological Wisdom, and the Party of Our Future. I commence with our prepared statement. Representing the views of at least 75,000 voters throughout the state, the Green Party of Minnesota heartily endorses this proposed mourning dove hunting prohibition legislation. In 2006, we passed a resolution demanding that the statute allowing the hunting of mourning doves be immediately repealed. This prohibition is in keeping with our holistic philosophy of living in harmony with nature and in adherence with our roots as an environmental party. Two of the Green Party's 10 key values are nonviolence and ecological wisdom. Regarding nonviolence, the hunting of mourning doves has arguably been for the sole purpose of target practice. The taking of life demands a complete evaluation of motives and needs and should commence only with great respect and dignity. Target practice falls far short of such considerations. Doves are also a symbol of peace. Regarding ecological wisdom, numerous studies have found it takes as many as 8 rounds before a hunter hits a mourning dove. And at this point, I would like to pause and, in respect for what's been spoken earlier today in the Senate hearings, I'd like to clarify that this is an average of 8 rounds per downed bird, and it's not a description of a single killing of a hunter shooting 8 times and then hitting a bird. And I apologize for the lack of, I take full responsibility for the awkward wording. Further, studies of mourning dove hunting patterns have demonstrated that an unusually high number of mourning doves are not recovered after being shot. These studies suggest that in comparison to other forms of hunting, the shooting of mourning doves has introduced higher amounts of lead and other substances and material into the environment. The hunting of mourning doves has also reduced numbers of a songbird enjoyed by many for its song. It should also be noted that unlike some species, which are considered by some to be pests because they eat farmers' crops, mourning doves actually benefit farmers by eating the seeds of weeds. Thank you very much for considering the views and philosophies of the Green Party.
Thank you very much. And your name again, one more time?
Bill Oldfather.
Okay. And any questions of the testifier? Thank you. Okay. We have any testifiers in support that would like to testify against the bill? Okay, Mr. Shores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Shores. I'm the past president of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'm the current legislative coordinator. It pleases the committee. I have some handouts. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for working me in. I have a tax appointment at 6:30. So
wish I had mine done. Just we'll get them. We'll get somebody. Go ahead with your testimony.
That's right. And I will endeavor to be brief. There are members of Mohawk here present, and from the NRA, that they would be available for opinions as well. I'd like to start by reminding this body of activities attributed to the Humane Society of the United States, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. The time frame is 1990s. The then and now leader of the Humane Society of the United States, a certain Wayne Pacell, announced that through the ballot box and through initiatives, hunting and fishing would come to an end in this country. During that time frame, Mr. Pacell was in Minnesota testifying against and debating with our DNR experts against archery deer seasons. They were also working on some fish issues, and they've always attacked our trappers. They seem to go after the small groups. The smaller groups are our hunting and fishing brotherhood. They never really confront us directly. One of the results of that time frame, folks associated with both groups were involved in Scott County and hunter harassment cases, specialized archery hunts in Murphy Hanrahan Park Reserve. The legislature, in its wisdom at that time, passed a hunter harassment law, making it illegal to get involved in any way, for whatever reason, with a legal ongoing hunt. I will state that the folks at the protesters were charged and convicted. All of this amounted to much concern amongst the hunting and fishing community. And in 1994, all the majority of the organizations in the state of Minnesota that consist of hunting and fishing and conservation concerns banded together, formed the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, and pushed for protections of our heritage via constitutional guarantee. In 1998, 78% of Minnesotans confirmed with their vote on the ballot initiative their preference to protect the ongoing hunting and fishing heritage that's dear to the state. We are a right-to-hunt state, ladies and gentlemen. Now I'd like to make a brief attempt, and I'll try to be quick, to refute some of these claims that the opposition has brought forward. Are they target practice? Do we put a lot of shots at these birds? They are as wily as a blue or green-winged teal. If you've ever hunted blue or green-winged teal, you know that they're an extremely flighty bird, an extreme challenge to shoot. There is no difference in the challenge. So you better have your target practice ready. You're not going to hit these birds. On the loss and waste issue, my folks at the Lake Country Retriever Club 400 Strong would take offense to the claim that we do not recover our downed birds. They and their hop-to-trot labs really get rocking when there's birds on the ground. We are required by law to retrieve everything we shoot. It's not ethical, and it's not lawful to allow game to lay in the fields. To my knowledge, there's been none of this, no complaints, no citations issued by enforcement in regards to that issue. I lease goose property. We cut corn. It's got a lot of, hopefully, just trashy fields. We have a lot of weed seed in there. We're shooting non-toxic shot when we're shooting waterfowl. Doves being a migratory bird that's protected by international treaty, we have made the adjustment to small non-toxic shot when we're shooting doves. Toxic shot in the fields is not an issue with us, and I believe the hunters in this state are going in that direction. In regards to economics, our good bird watchers out there provide, according to our friend here on the other side, $60 million worth of economy. I remind the committee, hunting and fishing is a $4 billion industry in this state. We are self-taxed. I know of no bird watcher that has excise taxes self-imposed to benefit resources. Dove hunting is an excellent recruitment tool. In the Senate, we have by reference to Dan Richman. He's a chapter president of the Mississippi Longhorns over in Hastings. And his youth mentorship program, he put 120 kids in the field through measured dove hunts in that 4-year time frame. I myself have put 2 dozen kids through. It's a great introductory tool to the outdoors. We hunt at a time of year that's warm. The equipment necessities are minimal. They do need a lot of bullets. Again, we use non-toxic. We spot birds for them, so there's no mistaking. We are IDing our doves. We're not shooting any of them but doves when we shoot them. So we're not killing birds of prey or other songbirds. I would like to add some historic reference in regards to the bird of peace concept. When I testified 4 years ago on the regaining of dove season, I had indicated that time conversations I had with my parish priest, the Reverend Joe Fink. Some of you may remember that I had relayed his information. Joe is from South Dakota, is an avid dove hunter, and I asked him about the historic religious significance of the bird of peace. He told me, he relayed to me, that it first showed up in the Old Testament, Noah and the Ark. When the Ark hit the top of the mountain, they sent out a crow looking for some form of dry land. The crow never came back. The next bird they sent out was the pure white turtle dove. It came back with a spray dove of vegetation. So they knew that salvation was at hand. Other Old Testament labelings would be the faithful when they went to temples in Jerusalem. The Hebrews at the time would purchase the turtle dove. They would use them for sacrificial offering. The purity of the bird was essential. Later in the New Testament, the Christians symbolized the bird of peace as a pure white turtle dove, the Holy Spirit, the part of the Trinity. That's thousands of years of bird peace tradition, ladies and gentlemen. So what's in a name? Sportsmen in this state and nationwide tend to put nickname monikers on the prey they chase. Mallard duck might be known as a greenhead or a curly tail. The Chinese bring that pheasant parrot, thunder chicken. The grayback is a canvasback. Some of our golf course enthusiasts and park lovers. Think the magnificent Charlotte Canada goose.
We know where you're at.
Is a sky carp, and that's very erroneous. But so what's in a name? I've heard morning doves referred to as spit doves because of the pointy long tail. I've heard them referred to as rock pigeons because they use grit in rocky areas, gravel areas. That's where they pick up their grit. That's essential for their life. If we are concerned or we are confused by what the bird of peace looks like, all we have to do is drive down John Ireland to the cathedral and look on the roof of the ceiling of the sanctuary. That bird of peace is depicted in the sanctuary ceiling. She's a pure white bird with a square tail. A common rock pigeon, a dusty bird with a pointy tail about the size of a peel. And with that, I would encourage the committee to vote no on House File 2501. Reassure the sportsmen of this state that they are now, this small portion is reconnected to their heritage. Allow us to continue to grow that heritage. And remember, as always, we are right to hunt in free state. I thank you, thanks to the committee, and stand for questions.
No questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Horst. Did you have a question? Okay. Yep, next. Ms. Bogus, are you coming up? Thank you. We'll have the department up right now. And I've got a couple of questions for you, Mr. Bogus. I want you to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Minnesota DNR.
I know you're not in enforcement. Representative Cornish is in former enforcement. We'd like to remind him of that. But I recall that there's wanton waste laws about retrieval of all types of game that are taken, whether they're big game, small game, the waterfowl. Could you give us a little piece on that?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, there is a statute that requires that a person not waste the usable part of any protected species of animal, and that includes due diligence and retrieval of animals that they shoot.
All right. Kind of opened it up for questions already. Does anyone else have any questions? Except one question I have is, does the department support the continuing the dove season?
Mr. Chair, we were supportive of the passage of the dove season authority in 2004. We continue to support it. It is the mourning dove is classified by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a migratory game bird. It's the most abundant migratory game bird in North America. It's also classified under treaty with Canada and Mexico. The Migratory Bird Treaty is a migratory game bird. Hunting does not affect dove populations. The harvest here and in other parts of the country is less than 10% of the population. So we have to set seasons within frameworks for doves like we do for waterfowl and other migratory birds, and they are managed to make sure that hunting is not going to have a detrimental impact on the population, so we do support the continuation.
In the event of dove fields, has the department made some effort to for state lands or lands that are owned by state lands to make non-toxic shot where there's some type of heavy concentration of dove use already?
Mr. Chair and members, we do have a few areas on wildlife management areas that are managed as dove fields, and we do have a rule requiring non-toxic shot on those fields.
Okay, and I don't see anyone here right now from enforcement, and so this may not be a fair question to you, but maybe someone else. I don't see Mr. Meyer in here either. Could you characterize the, are you able to characterize the type of violations, if any, that have occurred since we had a dove season? Over-harvest, wanton waste, uncased guns, any kind of, or Pat Watts, somebody said, I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see, although everybody.
I assume that Ms. Watts will correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not aware of any.
I didn't know if you were prepared for that, but Ms. Watts, welcome. If you'd introduce yourself, and then you heard the question, I think.
I did. Pat Watts with the Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division.
Thank you.
I truthfully don't know the answer to that question as far as violations. I could do, make some queries when I get back to the office tomorrow, forward that information, but I haven't heard of anything that jumped out that there was any huge problems that couldn't be dealt with, for whatever that's worth.
All right, thank you. If you could get back to Senator Chaudhry and I on that particular issue. All right. Other questions for Mr. Boggess or Ms. Watts, for that matter, from the membership? Representative McNamara.
I guess my questions would be for Deputy Director Boggess. There's been some talk about wildlife management areas and the opportunity for bird watching and such. Where does a lot of the money that we have these areas, like wildlife management areas and some of the public, is there a role that the hunting community plays in the funding of those areas?
It's about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, one of the original sources of acquisition money for wildlife management areas was a surcharge on the small game license that started in 1957, I believe, at $1. It's currently, I think, $7. But so there is a small game surcharge account that's dedicated to acquisition. We have gotten money through bonding, particularly in recent years. Legislature has been very good to us for bonding for wildlife management areas, which is not directly related to hunters. We've also gotten critical habitat match money from the lottery and the conservation plates that are on cars that's been used for acquisition of those areas. So there's been a variety of sources. The longest, most consistent source has been the surcharge on small game licenses.
Director McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then don't we also participate, those of us that are hunters, in the different stamps, the state duck stamp, the federal duck stamp, and I believe those areas, the federal wildlife waterfowl production areas. And correct me if I'm wrong, those areas are open year-round to the public for bird watching, and is there there's no charge for them to go in. They're free to visit those areas, even though some of those areas were specifically bought with the hunter income produced off the hunting licenses. They're open for all to enjoy and to produce songbirds and game birds, and et cetera. Would that be a true statement?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that's correct. The waterfowl production areas, which are federal areas, very similar to state wildlife management areas, are purchased with federal duck stamp dollars.
Okay, Representative McNamara, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then along those lines, there's been some discussion about how the population of mourning doves, like different birds, be they pheasants or whatever, can fluctuate up and down on a number of different conditions. And I think some folks would argue that the DNR would have the season whether it was a reality or not, and whether we really should support one. I believe you've shown through experience that you're willing to make hard decisions in the closed seasons if you need to. Have you ever in the past closed the Minnesota white-tailed deer season?
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, yes, we did close the season in 1971 because of a series of severe winters and a low population and an inability of our management system at that time to be able to keep the harvest within a sustainable range.
McNamara.
So you actually closed the season that today, well, over what, 400,000 or 500,000 people participate in?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, yes, we have about 550,000 deer hunters today taking 250,000 deer.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions of Mr. Boggess at this time? I don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Yaros, the bill, we got started without you, and we are now glad that you're here, and the chair moved the bill without recommendation.
Right, Mr. Chairman.
So we're ready to listen to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm sorry I had a lot. I was so excited to come here, and I thought I was number one, so, and I had another committee, so I locked my keys in the car and had to go back to allow the officer to get in the car.
I did that over to Kelly and one.
Oh, okay.
Come over, and I was shocked because I went into the security office over there. My car was right in front of the Kelly Inn, in front of the doors, and they zeroed down with their TV cameras on the place where it said Wally's Auto or Minnesota and asked me if that was my car. So watch out when you go outside the Kelly Inn. You don't know what they might see. Go ahead.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm sorry this is taking up so much time, but...
No, you're fine. Go right ahead.
An important bill. I've been here off and on for 36 years, and I believe it was only about 4 years ago that we voted on this bill, and it was defeated, or an amendment, and then, what was it, 2 years ago we passed it on the floor, I think. Well, I'm not against hunting and fishing, and I've never seen anybody here introducing bills to regulate rifles or to prevent people from using rifles to hunt or fishing rods or whatever. And but I have supported regulations of handguns and assault rifles, which are mostly used to kill people. I do not hunt and fish that much. I never had the luxury to when I was living in Bosnia and former Yugoslavia. I lived mostly on the farm, so I saw a lot of hunting and butchering. We were butchering large animals and poultry, and I never really liked it. You know, I remember once my dad was butchering a pig, and I remember that pig from the time it was small in the spring until in the fall, and my dad wanted me to hold a pan so we could save the blood, so to make blood sausages. And I started crying. I said, I can't. I like this pig too much. And my dad said, Barbara, my mother, come here and hold this. He'll never amount to be a man. I said, well, maybe he was right. And then when I decided to go into priesthood, to study to be a priest, said, Barbara, what did I tell you? He's not a real man. I couldn't believe that such small birds would be hunted. As I said before, I'm sort of a wimp. I don't even like killing big birds and animals. But, you know, we did it, and I've done it. And I don't really like it. But such small birds, I know that DNR needs money. We haven't been giving him enough money. I voted for the MOA bill to give the outdoors and other programs more money, because we haven't really funded those programs adequately. So I know every departments are desperate for their fees and license fees and so on. But I just cannot see hunting those small birds. I mean, don't they fall apart in the air when someone shoots them? I mean, maybe I don't know enough about guns, but you know, what kind of bullets do you use? Those big ones, or I guess there's some shrapnel, those small ones too. That's what's used on it. Because I know I used to help hunters in Bosnia hunt rabbits, and then we were trying to get rid of the fox too, because they were eating farmers' chickens and other poultry. So they use those thick, big bullets, and I think those bullets would just destroy those poor little birds. Well, anyway, so it's the small. Well, no, I just don't like the idea, and I hope that you will include this in your. What is it? You're going to have an omnibus bill?
Well, actually, we're going to make an attempt in a few moments to pass it out of this committee without recommendation.
To the
Environment Policy Committee.
Okay.
So, any questions for Representative Yarros? Anyone? All right. Thank you very much. Unless you have something more.
Thank you for your time.
So one more. Is anyone else in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? Appears that there is not. Are there any members of the committee that have any further discussion on the bill?
There being none, the chair renews his motion to move the bill from this committee to the Environment Policy Committee without recommendation. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the chair votes no.
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 The motion does not prevail. Thank you very much. Okay, we are going to take up House File 3350, Artificial Lights and Shining Restrictions. Mr. Botsick. And we're going to lay this up behind. Okay, the chair will move House File 3350 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. My bill, right? Moving it. Mr. Botsick, do the bill, do my bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the members of the division. My name is Gary Botsick, Executive Director for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. I want to just give you a little background. First of all, thank the chairman for introducing this bill on our behalf. The Minnesota Conservation Federation first got involved and interested in this issue a couple years ago. Our policies or the legislation that my members asked me to work on is based on resolutions once a year at the annual meeting. And in 06, at the St. Cloud meeting, they asked me to work on a shining issue, artificial light, the illegal use of shining artificial light that affects, in their case, this came from the Lewiston Sportsman Club, and they were most interested or concerned about the shining that was occurring, artificial light that was ending up in cattle yards and in private lands, mostly scaring domestic cows, particularly cattle, but sometimes horses. Okay, that's our involvement. Meanwhile, 2007, Senator Senjan and Representative Dammer introduced legislation, Senate File 1645. I didn't grab the House file. And this was brought to them from the Bluffland Whitetails Association, a Southeast Minnesota nonprofit. I've got one of their leaders here with me, and he's going to do a little presentation as well. This legislation, as I mentioned, was introduced in 07, in the 07 session, and just like our resolution, didn't exactly hit all the issues that needed to be addressed. So what happened, Mr. Chairman, with no legislation passing last year, the two groups, with the encouragement of the Department of Natural Resources Enforcement Division, got together, reviewed the entire situation as we related to artificial light and shining that was occurring in Minnesota, went over the statute, and came up with this new bill, which, Mr. Chairman, you were nice enough to drop into the hopper for us just last week, 3350. Senate file is in as well. And, Mr. Chairman, two meetings resulted last October and December, as I mentioned, hosted and facilitated by the Department of Natural Resources, including Pat Watts, who's here today, and three other conservation officers were part of that contingency. We met twice, as I mentioned, and came up with the following language that you see in House File 3350. And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, basically there's three subdivisions to the bill. Artificial light used to locate animals is located in Minnesota Statute 97B. The first subdivision deals with use of artificial light as it relates to when you have with firearms or with bows. Subdivision 2 deals with artificial light without firearms, and now Subdivision 3, which is a new subdivision, all the exceptions. Many of you that are familiar with shining or artificial law statutes in Minnesota remember how we sort of amended them on kind of helter-skelterly throughout the year. So what we did is recodified and brought all those exceptions into one section now called Subdivision 3. And we'll go through those in some limited detail, subject to your questions. Subdivision 1, which relates to shining with firearms and bows, this subdivision prohibits shining with an artificial light while in possession of a firearm, bow, or other implement that could be used to take small game and unprotected wild animals as well as big game. The exceptions have been removed from the sections I mentioned. They're generally now found in Sub 3. There is no longer an exception provided for possessing firearms that are unloaded or uncased, and that's caused by the
changes in some of the vehicles with the hatchbacks, etc. So that provision is gone. That's no longer an exception, and you may want to make note of that. Sub 2, signing without firearms onto private agricultural or residential property. There are the major changes there. There is where the current language in statutes talks about the season of September 1 through December 31. That has been eliminated, so this would apply year-round. The hours which current law talk about between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., that has been eliminated and replaced with a 1 hour after sunset until sunrise provision. If you see that on line 2.11 and 2.12. So that would be the window of opportunity for so-called recreational shining. That would give a grandpa or grandma a chance to take the grandkids out to see deer or bear, but it would be very, it would be limited to 1 hour after sunset until sunrise. Mr. Chairman, it goes on then to talk about the sub A and subdivision 2 A relates to the wildlife provision. Sub B relates to the agricultural provision. C, as you see, has been eliminated because that was one of the exceptions. And now the new C relates to, paragraph C generally prohibits shining onto residential property. That's the residential section. That's the new C. And the new D allows a landowner to post his property to no shining. This would include agricultural property could be posted, residential property could be posted. These sign limitations or the sign provisions would be similar to the sign provisions that are provided in section 8490 and the outdoor recreation trespass sign requirements as far as size and letter quality and color. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, subdivision 3, as I mentioned earlier, is the exception. That's where you find the language that allows the taking of raccoon, fox, coyote. It's also more importantly, or equally as importantly, as we're finding out from some questions that were raised in the last couple of days, if you get down to the end of the bill, there's a provision that, for instance, carry out any agricultural, this would apply to the egg industry, safety, obviously emergency vehicles there, normal vehicle operations, that includes the pizza man trying to find a house in the rural area or in small towns or in Rochester, as Marty's going to talk about. This shining issue is no longer just an agricultural or a rural issue. The shining is occurring in some of the cities, particularly in southeast Minnesota, because of the overabundance of deer. So that would also allow delivery guys to see the house numbers by shining that light that they might have on their vehicle. That's not in violation of the law, but would be an exception to this use of an artificial light. And finally, the last provision there on the 3.19 relates to the Outdoor Recreation Act, and that would cover, for instance, if you were going to be setting up a tent in your backyard for the kids, and you had an artificial light, that would be the old camping out back, which was raised too, Mr. Chairman. So that's, in a nutshell, what our bill attempts to do. And with that, I'll turn it over to our representative here from the Bluffland Whitetails Association.
Welcome. You state your name for the record and go ahead and testify.
Martin Stubbshed from Rochester, Minnesota. Member of the Bluffland Whitetails in southeastern Minnesota, but also to enhance my credibility, I've been an archery retailer for 31 years in Rochester. So working with the hunting population basically most of my life gives me a lot of take on what the hunters want out there.
Do you sell crossbows?
Only to a handicap.
Okay. Go ahead.
And only to a handicap. Anyway, a few years ago, I helped pass the city ordinance in Rochester as far as being able to take deer within the city limits with a bow and arrow. And with that, it was a great discussion over many committee meetings of local residents coming in and giving their opinions about this. During that discussion time, I had kept chart of all the problems that residents were bringing in. And in the meantime, most of it had to deal with not so much that they didn't like the hunters taking care of the deer or even a wounding of the deer. It was the obsession of shining on their houses in the evening. We had one lady at that time even mention that her grandmother got so upset that she had to have some help afterwards just because of the scare of having lights shined into her bedroom in the evening. Olmsted County, and much like the southeastern Minnesota counties, are getting so divided up that we're shining with our 300 million powered candle watt lights that they can be used as could almost direct aircraft traffic coming down nowadays. So the shining bill is a demand that I'm seeing that the hunters want to have taken care of to eliminate. The idea of that shining has been put as a recreation of youth has always been a question in my mind that I would think that there could be definitely other activities that a father and son could share besides a recreational activity as far as shining of a deer. This committee that the proposal together for this bill was really brought to us by local conservation officers in my area, where they wanted this very strongly to pass and to get this bill cleaned up so that in efforts that they could take care of that spotlighting poacher. Back in February, was a great article, not a great article, a very sad article written in our post bulletin about teens shooting a number of deer in Dodge County. The writer here called it sadistic. All right. It's very tragic, and it's happening all the time. If any of you here received the Outdoor News, Minnesota Outdoor News column, if you read the Cuffs and Collars page there, you'll see just about every issue about issues of conservation officers talking about shining poachers and the number of occurrences that they have. So we're here today to encourage this bill to be passed from the Bluffton Whitetails and just the concerned bow hunters and hunters of Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay, questions of the testifiers from any of the members? Representative Kinnis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this comes from having a background working collecting moths and beetles when I was in school. And I'm wondering how this, and you do that at night using lights on sheets and using light traps, and I'm wondering how this relates to that, the taking of it says, or other implement, which we would say Garfield with cyanide and unprotected wild animals would be a bunch of insects. And I'm just wondering how this relates to that, or if that's been thought about, or if you get your own permits to do that in Minnesota.
Mr. Bodick.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, in Subdivision 3, I mentioned as the exceptions, if you follow with me there on that section that begins on 3.17, talks about the second line, or occupational-related activities. These exceptions relate, I didn't mention it when I summarized the bill, they all relate or modify, not, you know, do not involve taking wild animals. Obviously, moths are not wild animals. But that would be an occupation-related activity, so you would be exempted from this. In other words, you could use artificial light to conduct that so-called occupational or hobby type of activity, as I understand it.
Representative Canoe.
Just a clarification, thank you, Mr. Kelly. Just a clarification on wild animals. Is that defined, or okay, it's defined in statute as okay.
Mr. Chair, Adam, it is. I couldn't give you that definition. Pat Watts or Ed Bogus, yeah. but it is defined in statute, yes.
Well, we're going to have DNR up here. We'll get that answer in a moment, if that's right, with you, Representative. Any other Representative Simpson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is a question for yourself or Mr. Bozick or whomever wants to answer it. As I read this, you're saying that anybody that drives a vehicle onto a field and turns around will be subject to
spotting deer, or spotting on the field, shining on the field. Am I reading that correct?
Mr. Bostic.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, no, I don't believe so. I would go to the subdivision 2 without firearms. That section A relates to the wildlife, taking wildlife. The second one, B, is agricultural application. And again, you're on your own property. I don't see that as covered in either of those sections, as well as the exceptions, as I just mentioned, or did for Representative Canute say, that same 3.17 talks about clearing out any agricultural. So in that effect, you're turning around on your own land to check the crops, if you will, or look for a cow that might be out in the field. That would be an agricultural activity, therefore exempted from this artificial shining, which would allow you to use your light from your vehicle and or artificial light.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bostic, up in my area of the country, I think if we pass this with that type of provision in there, we better hire another 1,000 COs to try and enforce that, because I guarantee you the ones we have will never be able to keep up, because if you're going to do something like this, you better tighten this thing down and get it pretty fine defined. You're talking about spotlights, you're talking spotlights. But when you start talking vehicles, you're really opening up, I think, a huge, huge can of worms.
Representative Cornish.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, it's always included vehicles. It's never been specific about the spotlight, any type of illumination. And so I think this will actually help. And it does have an exception in there for normal vehicle operations also, and agriculture, emergency response, just about anything you could think of occupational related to people. But yeah, any time you, I think, have ever illuminated a field or woodland with your headlights, so this doesn't make it any worse.
President Simpson.
Well, to that point, I think our testifier earlier was talking about the spotlights with a million candlelight power and that type of stuff, and I think that's an activity that a lot of us kind of question, because I think you can almost get over with some of these spotlights that are out there today. I mean, they're so strong. And I think maybe there's some question about that, but I just would have a real problem with the car lights part of it. I think you're really opening up a real issue that's going to cause more misery than it's ever going to be worth. So,
Mr. Chairman, committee, that was brought up in our discussions through this, but it was also the CO's discretion of the wanting to take a wild animal. That discretion right there of turning the vehicle in a field, and then was it willingly of the take of the animal? Okay, so I know that was the CO has brought that up too.
Okay, any further questions of the testifier? Oh, Rick Zimmo, sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just along Representative Vincent's point, it seems, and Representative Cornish maybe made this clear, that this is no different. Whether you can drive your vehicle in an open field or on your property now than it would be if we passed this legislation. I mean, is that correct? Because I live in rural Minnesota and I drive my vehicle over to my barn to unload a bunch of dog food and, turn around and shine my headlights across my property. I mean, unless I have an intent actually to shoot something, I mean, it wasn't against the law before and would be against the law if we passed this law. Is that correct?
Mr. Bostic.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moe, yes, to the best of my understanding, this is not changing the headlight provision or, this is, as Marty mentioned, the conservation officers that helped us write this legislation based on their experience, are they looking for clarity? Yes, but they're also looking for, continuing common sense. Obviously, if you had an uncased gun or a strung bow in your vehicle, that might be different than if you're just unloading dog food in, an outbuilding. So, again, the common sense of the conservation officer, whether there's four of them or 400, is going to have to override. But that's why they were asking for clarity. We are attempting to give them clarity. As you can see, this artificial light is about as clear as
as trespass lots, it's very difficult and very built upon itself. So we were trying to codify, or not codify, but sort this out a little bit. But as you can see, we didn't hit all the high points or low points. It's just, every time you answer one question, it seems like two more pop up. But again, we're allowing, we're asking the conservation officers to use common sense, giving them the tools here to decide whether this is an attempt to take wildlife, or this is an attempt to get to your outbuildings, and I think, or turn around on your on agricultural land to look for a cow or a horse that may have broken out of its pen. That's again requires some common sense, and I think that's we have to continue to ask DNR conservation officers to provide that.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to have Ms. Kelleher is going to testify. Welcome, and you know what to do.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I believe with the Deer Hunters Association, we wrote a lot of this law 8 to 10 years ago, in my recollection. I'd just like to make a couple of distinctions from what Gary Bostwick was talking about. It appears to me the way the bill's drafted that there's no distinction between private property and public property. Also, if you look at page 2, subdivision 2, starts on line 210, during the deer season under current law, you can't shine at all on public or private property from 10 to 6 a.m. from the 1st of September to the 31st. That's what we agreed to put in, like I said, 8 to 10 years ago. And the other exemption is down on 227B, that between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m., a person may not cast a spotlight or handheld light onto residential property or building sites from a moving vehicle. Up above, it also talks about the ban on artificial light on a highway, in a field, a woodland, or forest, and also talks over here to, on 2.18 on fenced agricultural land containing livestock, which is under the current law. So we believe, from our perspective, that we've tightened this up quite a bit. And as I said, 8 to 10 years ago, my memory's not as good as it used to be. I am a recreational shiner. I mean, I've done it ever since I could drive a tractor on a farm that has lights. It basically takes a somewhat restrictive shining allowance today and restricts it to 1 hour after sunset, period. And I don't think it makes any distinction or allowances, and maybe Representative Cornish knows this better than I do, to allow the subjectivity of a conservation officer to determine whether you were hunting or poaching in this case or not. It just is a beta. And I think the first three subdivisions, the first two subdivisions, basically just ban all shining activities completely except for that 1 hour. And quite frankly, I think, you know, the best time to shine deer really is, you know, from 9 to 10 o'clock at night. I personally have sleeping disorders. I like to shine a little later in the night than that.
That's not the only disorder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But, you know, I mean, I think, and I'll give this last example, and then I'll just stand for questions. Down at the Swan Lake Duck Shack, it's off of a county road. There is a big gravel road that goes down to three farms and then out to the point where all the duck shacks are. There's an L at that point where you turn to go to the duck shacks. I have often seen deer as I'm coming down, gone past the L, turned around, and shined my lights with my Tahoe, my truck at the time, across that farmer's farm field. And looked at the deer for 20 minutes or so while they were, you know, doing their nighttime activity. This would ban that activity. And I think, you know, we made an attempt as the Deer Hunters Association to understand some of the farmers' concerns, specifically in that area of the state. And I think we very restricted the shining laws that are under the current statutes, and also very much tightened up the trespassing laws at the same time. Raised the fines. Did an exacerbated one if you get caught more than once or twice in a period of time that the fine escalates. And I should also add that in regards to poaching, the Deer Hunters Association this year is going to offer an amendment, hopefully, to this bill, the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, to raise the fines for poaching, which haven't been raised since the 1980s. And we felt that those fine schedules today don't really represent an adequate punishment or deterrent to people poaching.
Hey, Representative Moe.
I have a question for Representative Cornish.
Oh, Representative Cornish, will you yield?
Yeah. When you were working in the field, and I'm guessing you
ticketed people for shining before shining and actually shooting the deer. How do you determine if they're actually in, their intent is to shoot the deer and not to just sit out there for 20, 30 minutes looking out across the farm field? Because maybe they have the time to do that.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, it was easier for me because most of the time I had a decoy, and when you pop up out of the ditch or come up beside the vehicle or something, they don't know. You watch them, see if they've got their hands on the guns or unzipping something. If they're all sitting there with their family, got big smiles on their face, they're obviously not going to take it. But it's always been illegal to attempt to spot or locate or take, so just the mere spotting of it. But we've always given them a break, and that's why we had misdemeanor shining for the ones that really didn't think were going to take it. There was still a misdemeanor shining after 10 and with no intent to take it. But the problem is here, this is tightening up shining, but if you're worried about your tax dollar and the money in the game and fish licenses, the CO has to answer every single call you get for shining. Otherwise, nobody's going to call you anymore. And typically, I would be sitting at the supper table, 6:37, just after dark. You get a shining 20-some miles away, and you'd go out there, and here they are. They're just looking, but they've caused you to spend all that time and effort. You're running around all night on these people sitting on boat seats shining deer, and they don't have any intent. This, I think, is going to help tighten that up, where they give you the best time to actually see deer is just after sunset up until an hour. As soon as you get out there late at night, then you start to put doubt in the minds of what you're up to, and you're just running back and forth. I used to have five calls a night. You run all over the country when you could be working on real poachers, and you're just chasing people sitting on boat seats with big smiles on their face or drinking beer and shining. So this would help tighten it up. It tightens up the hours, and it gives all sorts of exemptions: agricultural, recreational, trapping, hunting, coyote, just about anything you can do out there is exempted, normal occupational driving. So this would tighten it up, and they're just after the bad guys. I don't think this is that onerous of a legislation, really.
So, Representative Cornish, this would make it easier for a CO and not more difficult to make that.
Oh, yeah, it'd make it much easier because you would know after a certain amount of time. And they're not going to enforce this to the teeth the first year. In all our new laws, about the first year or two, you give warnings, you know, instead of citations. This would make it a lot easier because you would know probably after these hours are up and you're into the illegal part of it, then you're a little more certain that you're going to a serious call instead of just lookers. And this would cut down on the running, and it would make for less confrontational contact, because if you got somebody sitting in the middle of a field with a spotlight, you don't know if they've got the gun out or not. I've walked up in vehicles before, they have the gun out the window and they shot once and you just grab it right out of their hands. And this way, it'll cut down on those type of bad confrontations and safety issues and coming up in a mother and a son, and because you've got to approach these very carefully sometimes with your gun out, because you know what's going on. Here there's a family looking at deer, and so it's going to make it better. You try not to scare them, but I mean, it's midnight out there, your butt hanging out.
Representative Cornish, are you saying that you use common sense as well?
Yeah.
And that's on the record. Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chairman, just one more comment. In the page 3 at the bottom of the bill, it says the carryout act, outdoor recreation is defined in 97B001 that is not related to spotting, locating, or taking a wild animal. One of the circumstances that we're concerned, I don't know what that statute really allows and doesn't allow, but it's similar to what Representative Knuth was talking about other side effects of tightening it up to 1 hour after sunset. Retrieving game is going to be an issue. People hunt right before dusk. You harvest the deer takes off to the woods. It's now dark 30 minutes later. It could take you a good couple of hours to find, locate, retrieve your animal. Discussion about want and waste earlier. How do you do that in the pitch black in the middle of the woods without some sort of major league spotlight or flashlight?
For sure.
Snowmobiling, all sorts of other kinds of activities that I think this would severely limit. And I don't know that this allows any recreational shining or any sort of shining activity in regards to retrieving game outside that 1 hour window of opportunity.
Representative Cornish.
Well, if you're retrieving game at night, I don't really see much reason to take a fireman unless you're after a bear. We've been hunting bear for 20 some years, and I don't know of anybody that's ever really gotten tagged for. I mean, we allow that if you go out with a firearm now. And if it went back to that common sense thing, and
Mr. Chairman,
I don't know if we've ever heard of anybody getting hassled for defeating big game in the evening.
This still outlaws shining outside that 1 hour opportunity with or without a firearm.
So if I took my firearm back to my truck and then took a spotlight out to go retrieve my deer, I'm outside that 1 hour of opportunity. I'm in violation of this proposed law.
Same way last year, prior to this, it was 10 o'clock. You could shine up until 10. So, I mean, a lot of the game you get at night is between 10 and 6. It was illegal before, and we didn't have any big problems with it. I don't know why it would be any more illegal after 6 than it would be after 10.
Representative Hagbarth, did your question get stated and answered? No, okay.
No.
Representative Hagbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do need to make a comment, and I have to disagree with Representative Cornish. First of all, I'd like to say that up until 1 hour after official sunset, it's still daylight. So that's one major part of the bill that's wrong. That's a huge problem. Representative Cornish, you know that you can shoot deer up to 1 hour after official sunset. Or 1 hour before.
Half hour.
Was it half hour?
Yeah.
And it's still daylight. And I can still, you know, I'm standing in my stand, I can still shoot it there. So it could be officially dark a half an hour after sunset. And I may have to go and get my, you know, I don't deer hunt with an ATV, but a lot of people do. We'll get my ATV, or maybe it's sitting there and I need to retrieve that animal. So you are going to be in violation with this law, trying to retrieve your deer if you shoot, you know, a half an hour after sunset. So the bill's got some major problems, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else like to testify for or against the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Come down.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to, is the DNR going to come down and speak on this? I have a few questions.
Coming down next.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
My name is Kent Holland. I'm with Bluffland Whitetail Association. And I've been working on this shining bill for about 4 years. We lent Pat Watts or Miss Watts to help us write with the language on about 4 years ago, and so I'm pretty familiar with what we've been trying to accomplish. First off, as far as the last question, right now, if you're tracking after 10 o'clock, you have to call a CO and get permission to shine from that point on. This would simply mean that you now have to call an hour after sunset to get permission to track the deer. And that's been the case for right on through. So now it's just a matter of you're now going to have to call a CO that much earlier to recover. As far as Mr. Keller's interpretation of the headlights, I agree with that. That was the intention and is the intention of our bill to tighten up all shining activities. It goes for everyone. I'm a landowner. It would apply to me. The idea is to cut down on the amount of poaching and cut down on the amount of law enforcement time being taken. It's not just COs. It's also sheriff's departments and just a lot of calls on shining. A lot of frustration from landowners. You won't talk to very many rural landowners that favor recreational shining, particularly nowadays with the lights that we've got available to us. In my part of the country, you can be three ridges over. I'm in southeastern Minnesota. Literally, these lights will just scan. You can see the lights 3 miles away easily. And so not intentionally shining into someone's window from the old days of the the headlight or the light that was attached to your car, that type of thing. Well, those were powerless lights compared to now. Now those lights are, if they're on the next bridge over, they're coming right into our windows, right into our house. Some of these things are the reasons. Our primary goal was to cut down on poaching. A lot of the shining activity is not even directly related to the act of poaching. It's related to patterning the deer. And coming back at a later time with just a flashlight, and I mean, it's so quick at that point in time because that deer is perfectly patterned. and they pretty well know where they're going to go, where it's going to be, and we've got a lot of animals, haven't we? So, anyway, that was our intent, and it is our hope that we'll get this passed.
Thank you, Ms. Horn. Any questions? Representative Cornish.
I'm going to follow my sword over this one. If you want to lay it over and work on it, it'd be great with me. I don't know what your intention is, Ms.
We're going to hear from the DNR next. Mm-hmm. Okay, Ms. Watt. Or Commissioner Meyer, either anyone who wants to testify on the bill. I suppose it's Ms. Watt. The department, Ms. Watt, welcome again. Department have a position on the bill?
We haven't actually taken a position. We did hold the meetings between all the parties and worked on drafting language and initial drafting. And you included legislative staff as well, and a couple legislators were invited to come as well. We don't have any issues that haven't been identified or any problems with the bill. You know, those were taken up at the time that we met with the group.
Okay, questions for President Packard?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering, we heard the last testifier say something about if you're going to be out tracking your deer, I shoot a deer at 10 after 5, for example, and a half an hour later it's dark, and I'm going to have to call somebody. I mean, there's a lot. I've shot a lot of deer at 5 o'clock, Mr. Chairman, of 10 after 5. And it's dark by the time I get down and find the deer and I'm starting to gut the deer. You're going to have a lot of people trying to call in. Not only that, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I'd be able to call in. I'm not in the middle of Lake Woods County and I don't have any cell phone reception up there. I don't know, you know, at my camp we don't have any telephones, so I don't know how that's going to happen. How does that take place? You know, you might have some farmer or something that might call in that sees a light shining out there because I'm going out there to try to clean my deer, and then all of a sudden I've got a game warden on me that's going to give me a ticket for shining when all I'm trying to do is retrieve my deer. So I've got some real problems with this, Mr. Chairman, so I'd like to know from Ms. Watts exactly how that's going to happen. What takes place there? I've never, you know, I haven't been out in the woods after 10 o'clock trying to take a flashlight and try to find a deer. A lot of times I might, you know, shoot a deer and not find it till the next morning, but I'm not out there at midnight trying to track it. So how does that actually take place? Or maybe Representative Cornish can tell us how that works when you call in and you're out in the middle of the woods. How's it going to happen now? Because I hear a lot of gunfire right about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Where are these people going to call in and who are they going to call to? Are they calling the local game warden or do you just get a blessing over the telephone that you can be out there? How does all this work?
Well, Representative Cornish, you're the expert on this in our committee, so let's hear from you on that question.
Well, the best way to answer it is 23 years as a game warden over countless number of people finding him in the woods on the trail of a deer. Never was a ticket ever issued for that, right? Last year, regardless of this bill, last year, if you go into the woods after dark with a light looking for a deer, you're illegal. But hundreds of people do it because they hit their deer and they wound it right at sunset and they go and look for it. Nobody gets tickets that I know of unless they're in there blazing away at night. So it's a common sense thing once again. And I don't think the DNR brought up the idea about calling in. That was somebody else's idea. We've never had a call-in program. But what I'm saying is it's been done for years. It was illegal last year to go get your game after dark with a light. You could never shine with a gun in your hands or a bow and arrow in your hands, but nobody gets tickets for it. You've run across somebody, they see a blood trail, they're after a deer, and as long as you don't catch them still throwing arrows out there or something, that lies deer.
All right. Thank you very much for Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess just one question of our witnesses. Do you feel, is this a poaching issue or is this a property rights issue?
It's fine.
One of our testifiers indicated that spotlights in their living room windows and so on and so forth. So how does the DNR look at this?
Representative and the committee, it was presented to us in those couple of meetings as actually those were both pieces. The shining on the agricultural property was added into the language, I want to say, maybe 8 to 10 years ago. And the shining on residential property was added in, I believe, shortly after that as well. So that, you know, our focus obviously with DNR has been on the shining wild animals and you know, taking more focus on that piece. But the parties that came together for this bill had interests both directions and both ways and concerns both ways. There was, we had heard from the Bluffline Whitetails group that there had been many incidents of shining where they felt there was people that were basically caging an area. You know, there was no firearms involved, so they were perfectly legal, but then that would be where the trophy deer were disappearing from after they'd been, you know, located. They would come back at another time. So there's, well, it seems like there's a direct line between the two issues. They actually kind of bleed over into each other a little bit.
President Simpson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I don't know that this is quite right for prime time either, but I guess has this really had statewide, I mean, has this been out statewide to regional areas? That, or did it come out of the round table out of St. Cloud or anything like that?
It did not, and we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion, and I think you'll find out shortly what the results are.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, members, just to give you an idea, when I was a lobbyist, long since 10, 12 years ago, they were trying to shut down or control shining in. It's been a problem that long, but it's just a pain in the rear. Is for shining, poaching, personal property rights, shining people's windows, the false calls, the whole thing's been a big pain in the rear, and they've been trying to control it for years and years. So it's been out in the public before. There's been a group down in Rochester that was active trying to control it 12 years ago.
All right, Chair of News's motion to lay the bill over, House File 3350, for possible inclusion. The next bill before us, well, actually, Representative Rukavina's bill, which was the extending of the trapping season, he has informed us that he has withdrawn that bill from consideration. So if there were any testifiers here, you showed up for no reason because the bill is not moving forward. Thank you, and I apologize if you did come for that bill. And the next one is, yeah. Okay. The next bill is, we're going to go back to House File 30. What is that? House File 3032, which is the Omnibus Lands Bill. And we had one bill that we needed to introduce today, and now is a bill. House File 3695, Representative Saylor, has to do with Clearwater County, the department, Ms. Lewis has informed us that the DNR is okay with the bill. And so the chair will move House File 3695 for possible inclusion into the Omnibus Lands Bill, which is House File 3032. And I believe the bill is being handed out right now, so we'll give just a couple of minutes. We also have an amendment to House File 3032. Is that a House, Carl? That amendment is being passed out. So we actually have two things that we'll be amending tonight or trying to amend into the House File 3032, an amendment in Carlton County and then the House File 3695, which is the Clearwater County land bill. So we have before us at this moment House the H3032A1 amendment regarding Carlton County, the department. That's the same one, correct?
No, it's
not. Okay. The department has said they have no problem with this amendment. If you'd like to, the chair will move the A1 amendment. If you'd like to look it over for a moment, we'll vote on it for inclusion into 3032. Came from us from Representative Hilde. He's in another committee. Ms. Meyer, Ms. Lewis says it's good to go. It's good to go. Okay, all in favor of incorporating the A1 amendment into House File 3032, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, then we're to the motion that I had before in House File 3695, which is now before you. It regards Clearwater County's Representative Saylor. Representative Moe, you know anything about this at all? I speak to it at all?
I think it's a fantastic bill.
Wonderful. Okay, well, Ms. Lewis said that she communicated to my office that the DNR was in good shape with this. Are there any questions on the House File 3695? Being none, all in favor of the motion to include it in House File 3032, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
and now we move the bill as amended to environmental policy. And so now the chair renews the, or makes the motion to send House File 3032 as amended to recommend to pass and go to Environment Policy, Representative Eakins Committee. Any discussion on the motion? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. All right? Thank you very much. So now we have members, the what we are going to term as the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, and that is House File 3547. And that is the motion the chair will move that's recommended to pass and go to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, which is Representative Eakins' committee. Now I'm going to go through, members, what's in the bill quickly. Or just in the amendment. Slightly ahead of myself there, members. So to get the bill ready to consider, we need to adopt the 3547A2 amendment, which is in your packet, and it was distributed today. And the amendment includes, and I'm going to go over those items, it includes, and in the amendment, the A2 amendment is House File 1749, which is Representative McNamara, pheasant hunting one extra rooster pheasant after the 16th day of pheasant season. That was in the bill last year when it left the House, came out in Commerce Committee. It includes House File 1228, which is modifying the lake trout season to match the lakes that were within the boundary waters. That would add, I believe, 15 days to the season for lakes that are outside the boundary waters. That's a very narrow band of lakes that's up in the border country. We asked last year for the department to report back to this committee and other committees about that. This House File 2794 is adding crossbow, making it legal for bear and turkey hunting during the regular firearm season, so we would have bear, turkey, and deer during the regular firearm season. House File 2610 is to authorizes anglers to take fish with two lines. House File 3043 is nighttime raccoon hunting hours modified. That was a hack farce bill. 2930 is a bear hunting drawing provision. House File 3285 is the turkey hunting application provisions. House File 2871 is a conservation angling license. All these bills we heard in this committee. And then House File 2722 is a Cornish bill regarding electronic licensing on the ELS, allowing for the posting and charging of a user charge for the use of credit cards for hunting and fishing licenses. Snowmobile permits, all the things that come through an ELS. Then we have in the amendment House File 3330, which is an uncased firearms report authored by Representative Cornish and myself and others as amended. Then we have House File 3282, which has to do with horse trail passes, a new deer license fee category, muzzleloader scopes allowed. Pardon me? Yeah, the original bill had the muzzleloader allowed, but the amendment that we made took out the muzzleloader provision. And special bear hunting permits. It was in the original bill, and we took that out, minus the permits for the special bear hunts for, what did we call that, for nonprofit groups, and also the scopes. Those are taken out in an amendment of House File 3282. And then House File 3283 was youth hunting regulations, and this establishes that 10 and 11-year-olds can hunt as long as they're with arm's reach for big game, arm's reach of a parent or guardian, and they receive a free license. It also includes free licenses for kids under the age of 16 for small game. And then the purpose of that is to have tracking so we can have a better understanding of a better understanding of the youth that are coming into to hunting sports. Representative Mo.
Sorry to back up a little bit. Just to be clear, our bill is not adding scopes to the muzzleloader.
That is correct.
Thank you.
The House Bill 3282 originally had scopes on muzzleloaders. As amended, we are taking that provision out, as well as taking out the hunting of the ability for the department to sell basically research or promotional or fundraising bear permits up to 10. That was the modification of that bill.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Westrum, House File 3079, was the fishing spearing earlier open season authorized, and that this would change the open date. If you remember the discussion we had here regarding when you could get on the ice, you could begin spearing under the Westrum bill as we amended it. He had it slightly different, but we decided as a committee that we were going to make it so that when you can get out there, it's up to you. You go out there and you can spear.
Can you make your own ice?
Well, that's a possibility. Then House File 1188 was the Aquatic Farm Licensing Ecological Value Protection Bill from Representative Scalzi. And that had many provisions in the bill, members. So we have included in this bill no renewal of licenses that are currently issued where federal migratory waterfowl money has been spent to purchase protective covenant easements or protective covenants, an easement for that particular property. That as those licenses expire, they will not be renewed. Also, that there will be no new licenses for that same activity. It also directs the DNR to create a plan to increase the license fees to equal the expenditures and add long-term goals and best management practices. If you'll think back about the forestry issues that developed over the last couple of decades, now we have certified land, we have best management practices, the loggers are certified, and we need to be moving towards that in the case of aquaculture so that we can support our, number one, our industry, and number two, however you rank them, the industry for bait production as well as fishing in this state. And I came up with the idea of doing the duck stamp, I'm going to call it the duck stamp ponds, because that represented about 14% of the, an estimate of about 14% of the natural waters that are currently licensed. And I talked to the aquaculture people, and they felt that that was something that they could live with. The non-renewal as their permit. Some of those permits go out as far as 5 years. Of course, some are less because they were issued a few years ago or last year. And so those will phase out, and the new ones will not be issued. Then there's the Brainard bill. Has the ammunition restrictions modified. This would essentially allow for the use of the 17 caliber rimfires and 22 long rifle, short, etc., to be used during those prohibited times. I believe it's Representative Cornish, 5 days before, 2 days after the deer season, so that small game hunters, small game and varmint hunters can continue to hunt during those periods on the shoulders just before and after the deer season. And then a master guide license. Instead of calling a master guide license, the outfitters desire that it be changed to an outfitter's license, and that rather than having the base license of 4 people, that the license be for 2 people, and that they can also add an additional 2 people, right? Unlimited number of people, but on each instance of unlimited, they would have to pay the full $8,250 for every person that they add thereafter. So we had it originally in the bill 4 people, which meant that the license would be 4 times $8,250. The outfitter says, let's move it down to 2 people, doesn't spend quite as much money, but if we want to add more, we'll pay the fee. So so that is the A2 amendment, members. And so I moved the A2 amendment to be amended to House File 3547. So discussion on the A2 amendment. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I just was checking that House File 3350, no portions of that got
put into the A2 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct. And as I said, Representative Simpson, you would learn the result of that, my motion, soon. I think that on the bill at hand, I understand, Representative Cornish, I authored that bill so that I could get it before so we could have a good discussion on the bill. And I think that we found some inconsistencies and some problems that exist in the bill that need to be worked on. And so if the interested parties are willing to go together, and I assume that would be Botvinnik and the deer hunters and Representative Cornish and whomever else, and come up with a better mousetrap before we get this bill to the House floor, or even maybe if we got it to the House floor and it's a kind of a piece in the valley, you can check that off on your bingo. We'll consider amending it onto the bill at that time. But I agree, Representative Hagbarth. I can't think of sitting in my house at my farm up in northern Minnesota where there's absolutely no cell service, and I'm only 20 miles from International Falls, and hearing in that last 15 minutes of usable light the number of high-powered rifle shots that are made, and thinking about having to call in an hour. I mean, it basically takes away a couple of hours of searching for the deer, and I frankly looked for a humongous buck, which I never got, that I shot until 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and then went back the next day and spent half a day trailing the damn thing. It just wouldn't die. Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent use of all the tools in your toolbox.
That's right. So this, I think it's a win-win that we try and go ahead and, try and work on
that. Single for somebody.
That's right. Okay, and then so further discussion on the A2 amendment. The House File 3547. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still a little concerned about House File 3283. The youth hunting regulation. Could you give me a little more comfort in that? Are these students going to have to take the full firearm safety? Right now, I believe they have to be 12 before they can take it. What's going to happen there?
The students, are you referring to the 10-11?
Yes.
They will not have to take the firearm safety until they reach their 12th birthday. The current situation, what they will be able to do is to go out with a parent or guardian who is within arm's reach.
Mm-hmm.
Now someone want to read exactly how it reads in the bill? Taylor?
Mr. Chair and members, those age 11 or 10 would need to be within immediate reach of the beach.
Immediate reach, and they would be able, the idea of this is try and get the 10 and 11-year-olds out to the deer camp, get them involved in hunting, have them under the, and you know, my intention here, Representative, to have them under the direct supervision of an adult. And I'm, you know, the intent here is, for example, if you were on the ground, have the parent or guardian sitting next to the person within immediate reach. If you're in a stand, the same type of thing. So that in case there was a judgment made by the youth, that there could be intervention. But I really think that we need to try and get the kids out there more sooner than later.
Just to give this comfortability with that, right now I believe the DNS, tell me if I'm wrong, but you can hunt a waterfowl or small game at any age, right, with your parents? I mean, so you can have a shotgun out there hunting already small game and waterfowl if you're, what, five? And so this is relating to big game and it's within our arm's reach, so I think it's workable.
Representative Simpson.
Oh, thank you, and I think the arm's reach is very important, and I'm certainly not against trying to get people out there. That's not the point.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if we're going to do this, is there a reason we wouldn't want them to do the safety certificate at age 10 then? I mean, what would be the downside of that?
I don't know that there would be at Representative Cornish.
Probably the big fiscal cost. I mean, you'd be adding in... be catching a lot in the younger grade. That's what, 11 you're saying?
Well, if you're going to start this at age 10, I'm just a little concerned about, I hate to say this, but we do probably have a few adult hunters out there that would maybe take their children out that maybe aren't as current on all the game laws and the hunting regulations as they should be. And I think that's one of the features of the safety certificate, is to bring them up to speed on what some of the safety issues are. So that would be my only concern.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in talking about this in years past, when we talked to firearms, the instructors for this, they said that the big reason for having it where it is that there's such a big jump in maturity for most kids. There are some that are ready to, you know, go when they're much younger, some not until they're older, but for the vast majority, it's that age right there where they see the biggest change and they're, more of them are ready to take it. So.
Well, all the arguments I've heard, all the arguments, and I I think I've thought that through, and I made, of course, the original bill didn't say this at all. You know, the original bill was substantially more liberal, and so I took those under consideration in the amending of that provision. And I'm hoping that people that will take their kids will be responsible adults, and that this will be a win-win for the deer hunting community rather than some problematic thing.
Thank you.
Further discussion on the A2 amendment. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chairman Dill. My question was on lines 9.13 and 1.4 and 1.5. So that provision just that will allow two lines anywhere. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. What this will make it the same as ice fishing, I believe. You can use two lines through the ice. You'll be able to use two lines out of a boat or off of a dock or off of a float plane float or whatever. Two lines. Further discussion on the A2 amendment. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the horse trail path, I don't remember what the conversation was last week when we had Mr. Potter here on the pass being visible on person or horse pack. And I see that's still in the bill. I didn't think that the DNR was in favor of that. Did we come to any kind of an agreement, or did we talk about that last week? I don't know.
Representative Ackbar, we talked about it being like a fishing or hunting license,
mm-hmm.
that it needed to be on the person, and that it didn't have to be visible on the person. Like in some states where you have to have your deer hunting license on the back of your jacket or visible, so a CO can see it a long way. We don't want that on the back of your jacket or visible, so a CO can see it a long way. We don't want that, and it's not really practical. And we also didn't want to put it on the horse's tack. Is that right, tack?
Yeah.
And I was thinking of some other part of the horse. But nonetheless, that it be on their person. And I personally just think that's reasonable.
And Mr. Chairman, don't get me wrong, I do agree with that. And I think this is the right way to go. I just wasn't sure how the people that brought this forward a couple of years ago, how they felt about it. I think they were in favor of actually having it visible. But I'm okay with it.
And then the other item, Representative Hackbarth, in that same section is about the riding, the same issue we had with the snowmobile and ATV trail issue. Riding, if you give a permit to have a state horse trail and you're on your own land with an ATV or snowmobile, now you can ride on the horse trail on your own land without having a horse trail pass.
And Mr. Chairman,
just common sense.
No one disagrees with that. Yeah. I'm sure
that's... So that's kind of trying to make it more consistent.
Yeah.
We learned, you know, valuable lessons when you were the chair of environment and doing it that way. So further discussion on the A2 amendment? Okay, Chair will renew his motion to incorporate the A2 amendment into House File 3547. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion does prevail. We have another amendment. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move the AO 8-12-12 amendment.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth moves the 12-12 amendment to the amendment, and that is to House File 3547.
That's
game and fish?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is actually an amendment for a bill that Representative Erickson was working on, and she was having some difficulty drafting it correctly, and she finally got the bill introduced, and I think it got a number today, and I'm not sure what that was, but Mr. Chairman, I've even changed the intent and the language of the bill from what she introduced today. This amendment simply says that rather than have your fish house off the lake in February, the February 28th or February 29th, the last day of February, that you can now have it on the lake until Monday, the first Monday in March. And with that, Mr. Chairman, and the reason for that is if she was trying to get at the fact that, like this year, for example, February 29th was on Friday, and then you're right at the weekend, and that kind of takes that last weekend that you could possibly be out there away from, you know, having your fish out on the lake. I think some resorts on probably Mille Lacs that came to her, and it was their idea maybe to push this, I'm not sure, But they missed out on that opportunity to have those people up there that last weekend. So this really only gives you maybe another week at the most. The way she originally had the bill drafted, it was going to allow for maybe up to 4 more days the way it was drafted, but the way I've changed it now, it would be up to about 7 days, maybe 3 more days the way she had it drafted. So it just simply says that you can have your fish out on the lake until the first Monday in March, and that has to be off.
Well, Representative Hackbar, the ice where I live is about 4 feet thick.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, because they canceled global warming this winter due to global freezing. And so you could probably leave the ice, leave your fish out safely on the ice until April 1st, mm-hmm. let alone March 1st. So have the DNR come up, Ms. Watts, or anyone else who wants to would like to testify on this bill. And while we're there, we'll have Representative Hansen. You have a question?
That was my question.
Yep. We'll have the DNR come up.
And, Mr. Chairman, there will be a technical change to the amendment that we have to make, too.
We're going
to
do that.
We can now
fully adopt. Okay, yep. You'd like to make your technical change?
On page 2, line 2.5, and the DNR can explain this change too. I'd like to draw a line through A comma clause.
Right. So Representative Hackbarth moved to amend amendment 1212 on line 2.5 to strike in the semicolons, A and the comma, following, and the word clause.
Correct.
In favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. The motion is adopted. And now, Ms. Watts, to the amendment as amended.
Committee, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Hackworth, I think actually what we would want for the amendment would be to strike clause 2, comma. And the reason for this is... The reason for the technical correction is last week there was a number of calls coming into our office with the public and officers questioning a line in the fishing regulations that said if you had a fish house that was north of that boundary at 200 and
right.
over that way, that you could leave your fish house on the ice if between midnight and sunrise, I believe. If it was not unattended. And they said, you know, they were questioning why not down in the south end of the state, and I thought, oh, that doesn't make sense. Let's go back and look at the statute. And this line 2.5 is actually where it is that requires it, because clause 2, back on, starting on line 1.14, is for the north end, the north of the boundary. So if we were to make this correction, the whole state would have the opportunity to be able to leave their fish houses on ice from midnight until sunrise as long as they're in the shelters after those deadlines. And it wouldn't be a different, it's confusing, you know, it wouldn't be just the north half of the state or the north part, it would be the south as well.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry I misunderstood what the amendment was supposed to be, the technical change. So I'm going to have to change that somehow.
Okay, Representative Hackbarth moved to reconsider the amendment to the amendment. Any discussion on the reconsideration? In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion prevails. All right, now we're under reconsideration. We'd like to amend the amendment.
And Ms. Chairman and Ms. Watts, it would be just clause and then the two in the parentheses that we need to eliminate.
And the comma, yes.
And the comma. Do we have that, Ms. Chairman?
Okay, Representative Hadbarth moves to amend the 1212 amendment on line 2.5 to remove the word clause, and then in semicolons the number 2 and the comma following the number 2 in semicolon. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, in favor of the, that all check out, Ms. Watts?
I'm sorry.
That's all checked out again, and we're all ready to go?
Correct.
Okay, in favor of the Hadbarth motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, House File 1212, or I mean, Amendment 1212 as amended. Any further comment, Mr. Farr?
Mr. Chairman, members, Ron Player, DNR Fish and Wildlife. No, I don't. It seems like a reasonable amendment.
Okay. And so, Representative Hackbarth renews his motion to incorporate the amendment as amended into House File 3547. In favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Now, the chair moves to renew his motion to send House File 3547. Oh, okay.
We have two more bills that we need to incorporate into the House File 3547 that we heard earlier. The first one is the Eakin bill, which was 3546, was the one that Senator Scoy came and made the presentation on. And then the second one is the first bill we did this evening, the Bigham bill, which was the turkey bill in Zone 601 for House File 3444. So the chair will move to incorporate the Eakin 3546 and the Bigham 3444 bill into House File 3547. Any discussion on the motion? Being none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and now we'll move, renew the motion to send House File 3547 as amended, recommended to pass to the Environment Policy Committee. No. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.